You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Breaking news here, we don't need the music bed. This courtesy of the BorowitzReport.com. Arguing that his motto, don't do stupid stuff, is not a coherent foreign policy, critics of President Obama are pressuring him to do stupid stuff without further delay. Senator John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham led the attack on Thursday, blasting Obama for failing to craft a stupid response to crises in Iraq, Syria, and Ukraine. McCain said, instead of reacting to these events with the haste and recklessness they deserve, the president has chosen to waste valuable time thinking. This goes against the most fundamental principles of American foreign policy. Graham also expressed frustration with the president, telling reporters, quote, the American people are waiting for President Obama to do something stupid, but their patience is wearing thin. In his most withering criticism, McCain called Obama's stubborn refusal to do stupid stuff a failure of leadership. If I were president, McCain said, you can bet your bottom dollar I would have done plenty of stupid stuff by now. Well, that's courtesy of Andy Borowitz and with permission. Let's get a little more rational perspective on this than John McCain or Lindsey Graham. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer. I'm mangling my words here, Pap. Sorry. America's lawyer on the line with us. RingofFireRadio.com. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Tom. You know, all this stupid stuff came together because of people like McCain. This ISIS story, I don't think people really understand the backstory that's so important. You know, in the 1980s, Reagan and Rumsfeld and the U.S. funded anti-Soviet rebels and provided huge weapons supply to bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, then after that, if you remember the history, merged with ISIS. And then together, the next step was ISIS and al-Qaeda pushed to overthrow Gaddafi in Libya and to reassert this strong Islamic regime. And for them doing that, the U.S. provided more money, more arms, more airstrike, and more moral support for ISIS. Then the al-Qaeda ISIS group recovered huge amounts of U.S. weapons that we left behind in Iraq. I mean, tons and tons of weapons. It's disgusting when you start seeing what they drove away with and carried away. So then ISIS turned those weapons on Sunnis in Iraq with those same arms while they were emboldened and supported by Iran. So the new ISIS and al-Qaeda fanatics, then they moved to Syria, even with more U.S. weapons. In fact, the U.S., what's so funny about that, the U.S. was referring to them as the honorable Syrian rebels who were favored to topple Assad. In the media, ISIS was characterized as this victimized rebel force trying to rid Syria of this brutal dictator. And he's very brutal, don't get me wrong. But who's wrong now? Who's worse now? At this point, even al-Qaeda, as you've pointed out on your show, al-Qaeda has begun to reject ISIS because of their ridiculous fanaticism. I mean, they're so crazy. And I love the analogy, the kudzu analogy. You know, they brought all this kudzu down to the southern part of the United States because they thought it was pretty and was going to solve an insect problem. And now they've re-engineered nature and kudzu is strangling everything. Well, that's ISIS.
Right.
ISIS has relied on a set of circumstances that we created, and that set of circumstances is remarkable. It's phenomenal.
Well, we not only created the circumstances. I mean, we didn't just create Al Qaeda. Bin Laden was calling it the Mujahideen. It's been a while since I've researched this, but my recollection is that either a U.S. intelligence agency or a U.S. media company invented the phrase Al Qaeda, which means the base in Arabic. Bin Laden thought, oh, that's cool, I'll use that. And with ISIS, I don't know why the president refers to it as ISIL, you know, in the Levant. I realize it's a larger area than just Iraq and Syria, but we also, as you point out, we created ISIS. It's like go ahead.
Yeah, well, Tom, there's another part of the creation too. ISIS has relied on set of circumstances that we generated by our conduct with the UK primarily. This evolving of ISIS required failed states. You had to have that. We helped do that in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. It required recruitment and growth for ISIS. And it became easy for them to do that because of the legacy that we left behind in these last 13 years of war on terror. I mean, let's go down the list. 9/11 sent the Bush regime into this frenzied, crazy idea of no plan, war on terror without any kind of plan. That left a trail of Muslim recruitment propaganda raging from Gitmo Dog on Naked Man videos. You remember that. I can visualize it right now. It was so ugly. The crucifixion torture photos from Abu Ghraib. The high-definition films of drones assassinating entire Muslim families somewhere out in a desert. The endless years of failed occupation attempts. Bin Laden kill films. Hundreds of thousands of other Muslim family members smart-bombed, Patriot-missiled to their graves. All this created the perfect petri dish, the perfect breeding ground for ISIS-quality extremism. It gave ISIS this avenue to recruit an almost complete acceptance of Muslims by Muslims all over the Middle East. So these are things that we brought about, Tom. This didn't just happen. This happened because you had idiots like Reagan and idiots like Bush and Cheney that said we can control the nature of the Middle East. We can bring kudzu into the Middle East. Well, the kudzu is ISIS, and it's strangling not just the Middle East. It'll strangle this entire entire part of the world unless we do something about it.
And then a year ago when McCain and Graham were saying to the president, okay, go bomb Syria. Let's take out al-Assad, who is more aligned with Iran than anybody else. He's an Alawite, so he's more of a Shia. They said, let's take him out. And President Obama said, nah, I think I'll leave that up to Congress. You know, I'm perfectly willing. We're all positioned. We're ready to go. So then when they didn't get that, they went to Prince Bandar, Bandar Bush, you know, Bandar bin Sultan,
right.
and said, can you get some rich Saudis to help, you know, these guys in Syria? So Bandar does, and all this money goes to the Salafi Sunnis, the fundamentalist Sunnis, and surprise, surprise, they become ISIS. It's like,
yeah, well,
go ahead.
Exactly. Well, the Saudis are still, I mean, that was then. The Saudi Arabian princes, the people that we're doing business with every day because of the petrodollar arrangement we have with them, they're still funding ISIS. Their money is going directly to ISIS as we speak. So they have this huge armament stash that we gave them. They have this huge propaganda machine that we gave them. And they have money coming from the Saudi Arabians. And the other part that the media misses, and it's just, it's incensing to me. I have a picture here where John McCain is actually meeting. He's meeting with ISIS, talking about what wonderful people they are. He's talking about how, you know, his discussion about how they're the future possibility of success in the Middle East. This is John McCain. Wow. And then, of course, Graham, just like him. These are the people that are critical right now of Obama for not doing anything. But this is what they helped create. McCain was right there when Reagan said, well, let's expand our war in Afghanistan. Let's arm everybody. Right. And that became al-Qaeda and bin Laden. And that has evolved now to ISIS. And unfortunately, Tom, we're in a position now where we have to do something. This is such a tyrannical, vile, evil force. We have to deal with it in some way, at least temporarily.
Well, and that's the bad news. The good news is that if we can empower the local people, if we can get locals involved, it seems that when ISIS takes over a city, within a few weeks, the people in the city are ready to get rid of ISIS.
Well, they will, but think about this. Typically, it's 400-1 between the Iraqi army that we supposedly trained, 400-1, and they still are running like school, like scared school children from ISIS.
Yeah. And ISIS was using a bullhorn as their weapon?
Yes.
Yeah, made that point yesterday. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringofireradio.com. Be sure to check it out. Pap, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mike Papantonio, at Mike Papantonio for Twitter. Of course, ringofireradio.com on the Internet. And welcome back. Welcome back, Mr. Papantonio.
Tom.
Hey, Mike. So what's coming up Sunday on Ring of Fire TV here on Free Speech TV?
I have C.J. Worldman's going to tell us why the evangelical politicians aren't thriving quite like they used to, but in the process they have done so much damage in the South. The list goes on almost endlessly for the damage they've done. Michael Berg's going to talk about the what states are trying to do to prevent the foreclosure nightmare, because the feds are doing nothing. The feds are simply giving Wall Street a total free pass on this. Obama has taken no action meaningful enough to do anything on foreclosure. Howard Nation is going to tell us that the FBI is more concerned about the threats of sovereign citizens, and we're going to talk about the specifics of who they are. Nancy Cohen is going to explain why the Republican Party can't seem to make women understand that they are on the side of women. And then David DeGraw is going to talk about the economic revolution. He's going to talk a bit about your book, The Crash, that you describe of 2016. And so it's an interesting set of guests.
That's interesting.
Topics.
I had David DeGraw on the TV show last Friday.
I saw that. He's been at this a long time. I think the book that he's written, the material that he's writing, he's worked on diligently for a long time, and it simply is something we all ought to be thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, what was so shocking about the statistics that he pulled together is that, according to his research, literally 70% of Americans find themselves now, as a consequence of 34 years of Reaganomics, declining wages, increasing expenses, they find themselves in a position where if they just are trying to maintain the lifestyle that they have at this moment, they will never get out of debt.
Right.
And, in fact, their debt will continuously increase for the rest of their lives.
And that same group of people that created that, Tom, have now captured, just in the United States, something like $18 trillion that they're not moving through the system. And then another, I think, $12 to $13 trillion are offshore, to where we have all of that money, trillions of dollars, that have been moved outside what we call the money column that capitalism requires in order for it to work. You've
right.
got to have that money put back into the money column, and our government's doing nothing to make that happen at all.
Right, and back before the Reagan tax cuts, that pretty much wasn't the case, because people weren't taking the large paychecks like that, and they didn't have, you know, they weren't sucking that kind of money out of the economy, because, hey, who wants to pay 74% in income tax?
And the worst part about it is, Tom, is when you take that and you give it to a billionaire that doesn't really need anything, he doesn't buy anything.
Right.
Therefore, the money sits, and it sits. You know, when FDR came away with the idea of the estate tax, one part of the idea is you have to have money in the system for capitalism to work. And when you have these mega billionaires simply taking it out of the system, saving it for the next generation in CDOs and swaps and synthetics, things we don't even, you know, can't even describe, that they have this sitting there, but it's not working within the capitalist system.
Yeah.
You know, and when you take that money out, the capitalism has a risk of really failing.
Yeah, I've suggested that we should have a wealth tax in the United States that doesn't kick in until $1 billion, and then hits 100% after $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if somebody can't live on $999 million, really? Anyhow, Mike Papatonio, America's attorney, host of Ring of Fire Radio, and host of Ring of Fire TV right here on Free Speech TV on Sundays at noon Eastern Time. RingofFireRadio.com, the website. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you.
It's always great talking. We'll be back. Tom Martin here with you. Boy, this ISIS thing, this is really a mess. Largely of our own creation. And so, anyway, just a couple of quick notes. If you are listening to our show on your iPhone or iPad using the Tom Hartman app, we are changing streams that feed that. And so if you're a new user who's downloaded it this week, you're in great shape. If you have been using the app for more than a week, what you need to do next week is go to the settings and tech support view in the app and just shake your device, and it'll reset the website that your app is looking at. So just an FYI, we will be pushing that out to all of our app users, and you know, you'll find that all over the place. But so that's what's going on with that. there is so much going on right now. This, in the theater of the absurd area, Congressman Mike Kennedy, a Republican from Utah, talking about why it's not a good idea to expand health care in the United States, why states should not take Medicaid expansion, and why even Obamacare itself was a bad idea, giving people health insurance. He says, and I quote, keep in mind, this is an actual legislator, one of the 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. This guy is from Utah, Republican. Quote, sometimes access to health care can be damaging and dangerous. I've heard, whenever people say I've heard, it's like, from who? That little voice in your head? I've heard from National Institutes of Health and otherwise that we're killing up to a million and a half people every year in our hospitals. It's access to hospitals that's killing those people. Right. I'll give you that the fifth or sixth leading cause of death in the United States is hospital-acquired infections and you know, is basically iatrogenic disease, disease that's the result of a whoops or a side effect that was not expected or anticipated or might have been with a prescription drug or what are they called, nonsarcoma? No, that's cancer, whatever it is, hospital-acquired infections. And it's like, you know, it kills, I think, it's like 10, 20,000 people a year. It's just some substantial number, but that's a reason why we shouldn't expand health care? Because our factory farms, misuse of antibiotics, have created superbugs. We now have super strep, super staph, super, you know, E. coli, super listeria. All largely as a result of factory farming, and, you know, they're getting into our hospitals now and they're killing people, but so therefore, let's just not give people health insurance. Right. Congressman Mike Kennedy, the brain of the day. It's amazing. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Democrats, Senators Richard Blumenthal and Tammy Baldwin are promoting a bill. It's called the Women's Health Protection Act. You know, the Republicans all around the country are putting abortion clinics, and these abortion clinics in many cases are also significant women's care centers, you know, where pap tests are done and breast cancer screenings and all kinds of things. Most of these organizations, you know, only a very small percentage of their budget goes to abortion. But in any case, even just plain old straight up abortion clinics, what they're doing is they're saying you have to have the same standards as a hospital if you're going to do these outpatient procedures called abortion. So what the bill says is, fine, apply those same standards to any outpatient clinic that does surgical procedures. Want to have a colonoscopy? You're going to have somebody sit you down, describe to you all the horrors of colonoscopy. You have a 24-hour waiting period. You have to watch a video of somebody melting down from a colonoscopy, about 1 in 1,000 actually punched through the wall of the intestine and caused people to bleed, and sometimes that leads to death. In fact, maybe we can give you an ultrasound, a forced ultrasound, stick a ultrasound wand up your butt. But that sounds pretty gross, doesn't it? My apologies. Anyhow, you want to have dental surgery? Fine. Your dentist's office has to be set up, to the same standards as a hospital. Want to have plastic surgery? Your plastic surgeons, this is a multi-billion dollar business in the United States. These offices are not set up as hospitals. So if you're going to do that to women, then you have to do it to everybody. I think that's kind of cool. And fast food workers are on strike right now in 150 cities across the United States today. Just in Kansas City, Missouri, 60 restaurants are going on strike. Mostly this is the big chains, the Wendy's, the McDonald's, the Burger Kings and whatnot. So we'll see how this works out. But I think that there is a real movement there. There is a real movement afoot of significant consequence that we need to be paying attention to. Did I tell you about the rogue cell phone towers? This is mind-boggling. I saw it on Democratic Underground yesterday. I saw it on Drudge today. So-called rogue cell phone towers. This is CBS News in Chicago reporting. The type that can intercept your mobile calls and data are cropping up all over the United States, including in Chicago. And they have a map of them all over the country. Seattle, Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, New York. It's pretty amazing. Down in Texas. You think that your phone is connected to a cell phone tower. It's not. And it's sucking down the data off your phone and monitoring everything you do. What's going on with this?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The speculation is that these might be run by the military and they might all be near military bases, but nobody knows for sure. Very strange. Very ledgy, adversely ugly, the good. Emma Sulkowitz, the Columbia University student, is earning praise around the media world for her creative and courageous senior project. For the next year, Sulkowitz will carry her mattress with her wherever she goes on campus. She will only stop carrying the mattress when the person who raped her is expelled from their school. Here's how she described the project to the Columbia Daily Spectator.
I think the other thing about beds is that they're... We keep them in our bedroom, which is like our intimate space, our private space, where we can retreat if we don't want to deal with anyone at that moment. But I think the past year or so of my life has been really marked by telling people what happened in that most intimate private space and bringing it out into the light. So I think the act of like carrying something that is normally found in our bedroom out in the light is supposed to mirror the way I've talked to the media and talked to different news channels, etc.
Being so public about such a traumatizing event takes a lot of courage. Good on Emma for being brave enough to use her personal experience as a way to get people thinking about such an important issue. The bad. Phil Robertson. During an appearance on Sean Hannity's show this week, the Duck Dynasty star laid out his plan for fighting ISIS. Convert them or kill them. No, seriously, check it out.
In this case, you either have to convert them, which I think is would be next to impossible. I'm not giving up on them, but I'm just saying either convert them or kill them. One or the other.
Pretty amazing. I don't know what's worse, the fact that Sean Hannity had Phil Robertson on his show to talk about ISIS? Or the fact that Phil Robertson's strategy for fighting ISIS sounds like it could have been said by someone in ISIS. Let's see. Guy with long beard says convert them or kill them. And the very, very ugly. Marion High School. The Bloomfield Hills, Michigan Catholic School is facing a lot of criticism this week for firing chemistry teacher Barbara Webb after she decided to have a baby with her wife. As Webb told a local news station, she tried to negotiate with Marion's administrators. Her contract prevents her from, quote, making any public display contrary to Catholic teaching, end quote. But they refused to give in. Here she is.
In hopes that we could work something out so that I could be discreet. You know, I wasn't intending to be out and loud about it, but hoping for maybe some type of leave so I can continue to work there, but still, you know, abide by that non-public aspect of the contract.
But Webb, who is just over 3 months pregnant, says the school gave her only two options, resign or be terminated.
Amazing. So basically, Webb lost her job because she loved another person so much that she wanted to start a family with them. The church's response to this, or the school's response to this, the Catholic school's response to this is very, very bad. By the way, you'll recall that there is a little piece in Obamacare, in the Obamacare law, that says that the subsidy that you get if you sign up for Obamacare and your income is below a couple hundred percent of poverty, if your income is below, I think, around 80 grand roughly, you will get some money from the government to help pay for your health insurance. That subsidy was pulled. If your state did not have an exchange, because of the wording of the Obamacare law, it was an imprecise wording of the law. And it assumed that every state was going to set up an exchange. And, you know, it's just like, this is why legislators are constantly tinkering with laws. You know, the Medicaid law has been amended thousands of times or hundreds of times anyway, Medicare law, Social Security law, all these things. But Republicans will not allow any amendment of Obamacare. They only want it to be repealed. And so the D.C. District Court had ruled that if you lived in an area that, you know, in a state that had no exchange and you were getting Obamacare, then you couldn't get that subsidy. The entire, and that was a three-judge panel. Now the entire court, what is it, nine people, Shana? Yeah, I think it's 11. The whole bunch, it's called en banc, the whole court sat and looked at this, and they just put on hold the ruling of their three of their own peers. Say what? They vacated it. Thank you. That's the fancy legal term, which means it's gone. It's just it's nuked. That decision doesn't exist any longer, which means in all probability this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, virtual certainty. And so the Supreme Court is going to have to decide, do we go with the intent of the lawmakers, which was to provide people with subsidies, or do we go with the letter of the law, which says your state has to have an exchange in order for you to qualify for a subsidy? And if the latter, then, you know, the states are going to have to scramble to set up something that looks like an exchange. It could just be a single web page that says, hi, this is Michigan's exchange. Click. Oh, that's right. Michigan has not expanded Medicaid, I don't think. Maybe they have. I don't know. Rick Snyder is the Republican governor there. I'm pretty sure they haven't. But whatever. You know, if North Carolina, I know they haven't. North Carolina, actually, they probably wouldn't set up there. So this, you know, it's like an opportunity for Republicans to screw more people. That's the net of the whole thing. So it's pretty amazing. Anyhow, your thoughts about the news of the day. Corky in Hilton, New York. You wanted to talk about ISIS, Corky? Oh, Corky, your phone is all screwed up. Try calling right back. Let's see how it works. David in Eureka, California, listed on KGOE. Hey, David, you had some thoughts on the fake cell phone towers?
Yeah, Tom. There's been a bunch of cases. Actually, the ACLU has a site on it. It's called the Stingray tracking device that, you know, major police departments, local and, you know, large city police departments are buying. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it intercepts your cell phone communications and does exactly what you're saying the towers do. So, you know, there's huge stories on it. There's a Wikipedia page about the Stingray device.
Hmm.
The story I heard was because the police department has a non-disclosure agreement with the company that makes them, but they ordered an antenna, and unfortunately that got disclosed because it wasn't a device directly related to the Stingray. But
right.
a reporter tracked it back and found out that the police were using it. Of course, they wouldn't answer any questions about it in Sacramento.
Right.
But, yeah, that's what I think it is, and you know, welcome to Surveillance USA.
Yeah, welcome to the brave new world. So you think it's police departments who are running these? This is, by the way, these are called man-in-the-middle attacks, and this is how phishing sites work on the Internet. You go to what you think, you know, say you're a customer of Bank of America, and you type in www.bankofamerica.com, but let's say you misspell bank or America or something, some common misspelling. And you may well find yourself on a phony website that looks just like the Bank of America's site, but is run by somebody who grabbed a URL that's got that misspelling. And, you know, they ask you to log on, and you log on with your password, your ID and password, and they then route you to the actual Bank of America site, and they pass through that information. And now you're on the real Bank of America site, and it looks like everything was just fine all along. But this man in the middle, this website that took your information, they now have your login and password, even though you're just merrily dealing with your bank online, thinking that everything is cool. And these man-in-the-middle attacks are just central to phishing. So if you've got a cell phone, particularly a smartphone, and you get a man-in-the-middle who is a rogue cell phone tower rather than a rogue website, and the cell phone tower now, everything you say is going through it, or your entire telephone conversation, any data you send, your email passwords, all of this stuff is going through this site. They basically have everything. If you have any banking apps or anything like that open on your phone, they're going to have that information. So you're saying, David, I mean, there's speculation. Could these be military? Could they be police? Could they be fishers? Could they be, you know, scammers? And you're saying it's the police departments.
It is. It's not speculation either. This is an actual device. There are stories on it. There are news agencies reporting on it now,
right,
trying to get more information on this, you know, local law enforcement surveillance of us.
Right.
Basically violating.
But does the Stingray,
once again,
does the Stingray do a man-in-the-middle attack,
right,
or does it just track you?
Yes. No, it does. It tracks you, and it does man-in-the-middle attacks as well. And, you know, this is what we know so far just from – you know, getting freedom of information from the police departments
right.
to tell us, and that's difficult in itself.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I've got to do some more homework on this. David, thanks for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. I'm telling you, we got the smartest listeners in the world. Corky, you want to try that again in Hilton, New York?
Yeah, is that better?
It sounds perfect.
Yeah, well, I wanted to compliment you and Pat. I could listen to you for hours.
Thank you.
Do what is supposed to be done. You explain today from the roots of history. Now, I want to call this, what I call this, the tribute for me.
Oh, here goes your phone, Corky. It just disintegrated again. I'm sorry, you're going to have to call back again. John in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for the education 5 days a week.
Thank you. What's on your mind? You want to talk about John McCain?
Yeah, two things. First of all, the Republican Party is nothing but a lobbyist group of corporations, as we all know.
Corporations and billionaires,
is,
yes.
Exactly. And second of all, based on what Pap said about John McCain, maybe it's time the U.S. needs to indict McCain.
I think the voters of Arizona should be indicting him in the ballot box by voting for his opponent, although he's not up for re-election this time around. And frankly, I doubt he'll run the next time. He's got to be in his 80s now. You're pushing that. I think that, John, the indictment needs to be in the court of public opinion. We need to publicize the fact that John McCain and Lindsey Graham basically, you know, were the help create ISIS, help promote ISIS. And John McCain was over there shaking their hands and congratulating them back a year ago when they were going to take down Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Thank you, John, for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
For the record, John McCain is 78 years old, so, well, who knows? Maybe he's got another Senate term in him. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh my, there were a couple of, yeah, here's the mysterious cell phone towers. Oh, this was amazing. The 10 most inhumane laws, courtesy of Southern Republicans. Alex Henderson writing over at alternate.org. The Mississippi anti-abortion law, number 1390. They plague, he says, Southern schools with failed abstinence-only sex ed programs, and then when girls get pregnant, they don't let them get an abortion. They make access to contraception more difficult and restrict abortion. Mississippi Republican Governor Phil Bryant has been quite open about his desire to make a Mississippi an abortion-free state, and he happily signed this into law, which says that if you're going to get an abortion, you've got to do it in a place that has admitting privileges of the local hospital. Excuse me. Again, a higher standard. Excuse me. A higher standard than any other outpatient surgery clinic is held to. And in Tennessee, the Tennessee Pregnancy Criminalization Law, Senate Bill 1391, this law says that if you are pregnant and you take, you know, some type of a narcotic, you can go to prison. And in fact, in July, Tennessee resident Mallory Loyola, 26, became the first woman arrested under the law. 2 days after giving birth to her daughter, who tested positive for methamphetamine, she was charged with assault. Congratulations, you have a healthy, happy baby, but you're not going to be able to care for it because we're going to put you in prison. I realize they're trying to make sure that you have healthy, happy babies, but this is not the way to do it. Because what this does, these kind of punitive laws, what they do is they cause substance abusers, pregnant substance abusers, to hide their substance abuse rather than seek help. I mean, you would think that the time that you would want somebody who is a drug addict to seek assistance or an alcohol addict to seek assistance would be when they realize that they're pregnant and they get it. I got to do something about this. I don't have the resources. I don't know how to deal with this. So instead of making it that they go to jail if when the baby is born and they test the blood and the cord for drugs, there's any drugs in there. Instead, why not open drug treatment clinics and, you know, offer a special deal for pregnant women? Well, that's too smart for Tennessee, the Republicans in Tennessee. They just, you know, hey, just throw the women in jail. Then they have the Tennessee's Turn Away the Gays bill. in Tennessee, State Senator Mike Bell, a Republican-sponsored Bill 2566, which would have allowed businesses to refuse to serve gay couples on religious grounds. Brilliant. Alabama and Louisiana, the many privileges. Again, North Carolina, their voter ID law. I mean, they're the politicians, Republican politicians in North Carolina, are getting pretty damn hysterical because, you know, their popularity is waning. And there's a lot of African-Americans in their state and people of Hispanic descent, just basically non-whites. And so the Republicans are like, and non-white males, I mean, basically white males are the Republican base. And so rural white males at that. So the Republicans are saying, okay, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that only rural white males can vote. And you know, and then they brag about it. What was that state senator from Pennsylvania said, you know, yeah, voter ID, check. You know, that's going to help us win the presidential race or whatever. It's bizarre. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Oh, yeah, good point, Jim. Susan in Chicago. Hey, Susan, what's on your mind today? Susan? I wonder if we have a phone problem. Do we need to reset our phones? I don't know. Let's see if Fred in Hillsboro, Maryland is there. Hey, Fred.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to your program a few days ago. You were talking with that Hannity robot about immigration. You mentioned E-Verify. Did you know there was a program before E-Verify called the I-9 that started back, I believe it was the late 80s, early 90s,
right,
where all your employees had to come in and show birth certificates and driver's license to verify citizenship?
Yeah.
It was a paper program. You talked about the manufacturers and all that, because I used to go to McAllen, which is down in the Rio Grande Valley back in the late 90s, every other week for almost a year. And I'd read the local paper when I was down there. And it was 6 to 10 pages every week of full, huge ads for, job openings. I mean, sometimes there was a big, there'd be four to a page.
Job openings just in McAllen, Texas, or job openings all over the country?
All over the country. Minnesota, New York, Colorado.
Oh, wow. So employers who are looking to hire people, undocumented aliens, are advertising in the newspapers of the Texas border towns?
That was back in the late 90s. I was going down there every other week for almost a year on a dedicated run, and I read newspapers a lot.
That's amazing.
And local papers. And there were, like I say, the amount of classified ads for jobs all over the country it blew my mind.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were for meat plants. You could tell that by either the name on it or the location.
Oh, the meat packers. Yeah, that's an industry that has, that's fascinating, because I always wondered why it was that construction and meat packing are the two major domestic industries that historically were unionized and were good jobs, you know, and now both construction and meat packing are largely not unionized and not good jobs, in large part because so many undocumented workers are working in those fields. And I was wondering, why is it just those industries? Apparently they've been advertising as an industry.
Well, I wanted to bring up one more thing. I read
sure.
this in an, I didn't write the name of the, I can't remember the name of the newspaper. Within the last 6 months, a guy wrote an article in an op-ed section. He was reviewing a book, and the author had written about, there were, since the mid-1800s, there have been four great migrations of Latinos, quote-unquote, whatever, coming out of Mexico, Central America, and the United States. And either because of golden opportunities here or massive unrest revolution back there.
Right.
And the first three, they came up, they lasted anywhere from 10 to 25 years, and they walked home. There was no big deal.
Yeah.
The last one, they came across, and then all of a sudden they started putting guns on the border, and they're thinking, I can't go home now.
Right.
You know, there's guns down there. It's just as dangerous to go back as it was to get here.
So
and they're staying here now.
So by locking up the borders, by turning America into East Berlin, we are locking in people who might otherwise have just basically been seasonal workers or you know, worked for a few years, made enough money to go back home and live the life of Riley.
I love that analogy with it, because I was in the military in Germany in the mid-70s, and I won a 4-day pass to East Berlin,
mm-hmm.
and it scared the crap out of me to see the wall, see the minefields, the guns, the rees along the wall, the lookouts,
yep,
and everything. It scared the crap out of me. And I listen to these people talk about we got to secure the border, but they're very vague on how to do it. But you know, yeah, what they want.
Yeah, they want the Berlin Wall. It's amazing. You're right, Fred. I was there also back in the 80s. We lived in Germany for a year in 86, 87. And there were two, the program that we worked with, Salem International, had a program in Kulm, in Stuttsteinach, where we lived, and also in Hörheim. And the Hörheim program, literally the back of the guest house that Louise and I used to stay in, our bedroom window looked out on the wall, the East German wall. And in the spring, when the ground was thawing and the snow was melting and the ground was thawing, we would be awakened in the morning by explosions just 100 yards from us, because the landmines that the Germans put in the dirt, you know, as the dirt started moving as a consequence of thawing, it would set off the landmines. And it was just, I mean, this is what we want to do with the southern, it's nuts. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Ken in Loveland, Colorado. Hey, Ken, you're running for, you or somebody else is running for Congress?
No, it's not me, but oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
But Cory Gardner's running against Tom Udall.
Uh-huh.
And Cory Gardner for years has been against any form of birth control.
Right.
And in June, he proposed to have it over-the-counter with no prescription, and he just said it would be cheaper and safer that way. Talk about a big turnaround.
Is this a Republican?
Where he's come, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Cory Gardner's Republican. Running against Tom Udall.
So he's decided his, I don't know that his whole party has a position on birth control, but, you know, it seems that virtually all the legislative efforts to restrict access to birth control have come out of Republicans.
But this is his new position.
Yeah.
As of June.
Yeah.
You can check it out.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Denise, you're saying Michigan did pass a Medicaid expansion?
Yeah.
Denise
in
Chicago?
I'm actually on it right. Yes, I'm here, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Michigan did pass it, and there was a Republican by the name of, I forget his first name, Amish, who crossed over and helped vote that through. So I'm not a big fan of, I'm not a big fan of what's happening in the state, but, you know, got to give them credit where credit is due. So that's what it's all about, you know, caring for people and doing the right thing. I also think that because of the corporate environment on the west side of the state, that because they are involved in a global company, I'm going to not say the names of it because I don't want anybody to recognize me and shoot myself in the foot. But I think it was done because of the perception that it would give around the world to a company located in Western Michigan.
So presumably that would be Tupperware, right?
Or no, would, Amway.
Or would that be Gerber?
Amway, yeah.
Or, I mean, there's
Amway.
Amway. Yeah, Amway. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
So they did pass it, and I'll tell you, it has some challenges, but there's always room for improvement.
Good. Well, that's interesting. So the DeVos family, I mean, they're the big players in Michigan politics, and their money is out of Amway. Correct me if I'm wrong.
But.
Go ahead.
And they're global, and they helped put Schneider in office, but they're a global company. But I'll tell you, they did pass the Medicaid, and I'm on it, and it's been a wonder thing.
Good. Denise, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Ben Kinchlow, former co-host of the 700 Club and author of Black Yellow Dogs. His website, BenKinchlow, KinchlowW.com. And Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on the program. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. Todd Starnes wrote a piece for the Fox News website in their military section about how the Navy has confirmed that they are going to start putting Bibles in the base lodges that Navy Exchange runs. And tell me, after the Freedom From Religion Foundation had complained about government-supported Bibles, give me the details on this.
Me?
Yeah. Do I have this right?
My understanding is that, and I'm not, I'm an expert on that, but my understanding is that the American Separation for Church and State, this group,
right,
put out a complaint about having Bibles in these units. They were there to begin with.
Right.
Passed
so,
by the American Bible Society.
Right, right, but as they do with hotel rooms all over the country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then this group comes in and complains about that and wants them removed.
Because it's on federal property.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the Navy then,
took them out.
Caves in.
And now they put them back in.
But now they're putting them back in.
Right. And this is good news because...
Well, you need to understand that what the First Amendment clearly articulates is, and what you hear from the anti-Bible, anti-religious group is always the so-called Establishment Clause. You hear that all the time, the Establishment Clause. But what you never hear them say anything about is the Free Exercise Clause. And what people need to understand is that in America, let me just read the first part of the First Amendment. You mind if I do that?
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Now, let's look at that the way it's written. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So
Right. The
moment that you tell me I can't practice my religion under the so-called Establishment Clause, you immediately violate my right to do so under the Free Exercise Clause.
Yeah.
And that's what these people forget, that
yeah,
there are two clauses there, not just
so,
one.
So I'm guessing that your argument is that the government is not buying these Bibles. The American Bible Society is providing them for free in these basically hotel rooms on Navy bases.
Exactly.
And because they're being provided for free, this is not government promoting religion. They're simply allowing them to be there. Would you have any problem if ISIS brought over their versions of the Quran and put them in all those bedside tables?
Yes, I would. I would have a great deal of concern about that.
Why?
Because ISIS is predicated upon the destruction of human life, the destruction of human liberties. It has nothing to do with...
No more than the Catholic Church was in the 13th century.
And the Catholic Church is now the Catholic Church and is not the official church of the United States of America.
Right, neither is ISIS.
But
I'm confused, Ben. You're in favor of people having the freedom to practice their own religion, and you're in favor of a federal facility accepting gifts that promote a particular religion, in this case Christianity, but you're not in favor of a federal facility accepting gifts that might promote a religion other than yours. That sounds to me not like freedom, but bigotry.
Oh, are you in favor of somebody coming in chopping off the head of your staff because they disagree with them?
No, I think that's illegal, but putting a Quran in the table next to the bed...
But you're saying it's okay to put the manual... this is how and why you should chop off somebody's head, but if they come in and chop off that person's head, then you're saying that's illegal. That
should. Well, I'm guessing, Ben, you haven't read the Bible. Yeah, our Bible, the Christian Bible.
I have read the Bible.
Okay, refer you to the book of Joshua, where God told Joshua to go into the city of Ai and kill every man, woman, and child, slit open the stomachs of pregnant women, and cut off the head of the guy who was the head of the city, the king of the city, and put it on a stake out in front. That's in our Bible. Beheading. It's in our Bible.
That's exactly right.
I don't, to the best of my knowledge, beheading does not show up anywhere in the Quran.
It doesn't have to. It shows up in practice.
Okay, so there is beheading in the Christian Bible. There is not beheading in the Quran. And you're in favor of having Christian Bibles in Navy facilities, but not Korans. Do I have that correct?
No, you do not.
What am I missing?
point is, you're not understanding why we have two separate Bible perspectives. You have to remember, when the Bible was first introduced to mankind, there were no laws of any kind.
That's nonsense.
No, there were no laws. Every
That's
man
nonsense.
Did that which was right in his own eyes.
That's nonsense. You've got at least 10,000 years worth of recorded history and arguably 20 or 30,000 years of oral history of societies all over the world who all had laws, rules, deities, creation traditions. I mean, all kinds of stuff. I mean, that statement is like, read your anthropology, Ben. It's just A and B. So what? If the Constitution, as you correctly point out, says that the government cannot prevent you from practicing your religion, and somebody practicing their religion gives Bibles to a hotel on a Navy base on federal property to put into the bedside stand, I don't understand why you would object to ISIS putting Korans into the bedside stand, or for that matter, the Church of Satan in New York City coming in and putting, you know, Beelzebub's tales to his grandson by Gurdjieff into the bedside stand.
Well, see, the reason you can make this ridiculous argument that you're making is because Western civilization is founded upon the whole concept of Judeo-Christian principles.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. As Thomas Jefferson pointed out, he said to say that the common law of England, and this is in the 1790s, he said to say that the common law in England is based
on forcing people to worship a particular religion.
Ben,
that's what the Church of England was about.
I refer you to a piece I wrote that's published over on Common Dreams about Judge Moore. If you just Google my name and Judge Moore's, you will find the quote from Jefferson there, although it's fairly easy to find, where he said to suggest, as David Hume, the British historian, did, that Christianity was part of the common law of England is a fraud of the clergy. He said our common law started in England around the year 500, and Christianity was not introduced to England until the year 800. Here is a period of 300 years where the common law was being established in our nation, and Christianity had no part of it.
And the common
Jefferson
law
called this a fraud of the clergy, what you're saying.
And the common law provided for a dictator, a monarch who could do just whatever that monarch felt like doing when he felt like doing it.
Well, you just said that that's the, you know, our common law is rooted in Judeo-Christian tradition. I mean, you can't have it both ways, Ben. You can't say somebody can put a Christian Bible next to somebody's bed, but they can't put a Koran next to their bed. That's interfering with their freedom of religion.
If somebody wants to be a Muslim in this country, they are free to practice their religion in this country.
But they can't put their Bible next to your bed if you're staying with the Navy.
If somebody wants to donate Koran to somebody, that's fine. Let them do it.
So you're now in favor of ISIS coming over and putting Korans into the bedside stands?
No. You see, what you're saying is what you're trying to do is you're trying to change the whole concept here.
No, what I'm saying is religious freedom is religious freedom. Very simple concept.
ISIS is not about religion.
You think that they're not motivated by religion?
I think they are motivated by a particular aspect of their political and social and religious, which is all intertwined.
Well, you're right on that. You're right. I mean, this is Sunni versus Shia, and you could argue that that's, you know, our sect versus your sect as much as it. But it happens within the realm of religion.
Except we don't kill each other off in a Christian religion.
Not too often, but we do. We do. Ben Kinchlow, former co-host of the 700 Club, author of Black Yellow Dogs. Ben Kinchlow, KINCHLOW.com is the website. Thanks, Ben.
Yep.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, ask Dr. Tiller if people kill in the name of Christianity in this country. It's still going on. We're killing abortion doctors. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Donald in Phoenix, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Donald. I've got a green light here.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm well. What's up?
This is a social, network kind of distribution of the PDA's work here in Arizona.
Okay, Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, yep.
Right. They've got enough signatures gathered here in Arizona. They're going to present them to John McCain in his office today at around noon or somewhere thereabouts, if he's there, that is.
Yeah. In his office in Phoenix?
But that's just, yes, it is. Yeah. In his office here, yes.
Yeah, and what do the petitions say?
Pardon?
What do the petitions say? What is the purpose of the petitions? I'm sorry.
Oh, it's for the move to amend.org.
Oh, okay. To pass an amendment to amend the to pass an amendment to the Constitution saying that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech.
That's correct.
Good on you, Donald. Go ahead.
No, I just want to let everybody know if they're living in Phoenix, this area, maybe they can make it down there today.
Yeah. Okay. That's in the, where is that again?
I got the exact address. I don't know.
Okay. It would be over at the PDA website, though, right?
Yeah. It's 2218 North something. I can't give you the exact address.
Yeah.
But that's where it's about.
Okay. Well, we'll just refer people to PDA's website and, they can go to the Arizona chapter. And so very good on you. Did you help collect some of those signatures, Donald?
Well, unfortunately, I can take credit for that one.
Uh-huh.
I wish I could. I was out to Illinois. I visited my mom. She just got through in hospital. She had 4 seizures.
Oh, geez.
So
well,
kind of
but good on you for calling up and sharing the story with us. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and keep up the great work, Donald. Jim in Lehigh Acres, Florida. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. There's a short article that's on the front page of the Fort Myers News Press about Florida's alternative to Obamacare.
Right.
What a bust it is. Yeah, 6 months after going online and 6 years after the state's leaders, GOP, conceived it as a free market response to calls for federal health reform, Florida Health Choices has found only about 30 customers, according to its chief.
Yeah, this was their alternative to Medicaid expansion. It's bizarre.
Yeah, they spent $2.4 million in taxpayer funding since 2008 on this ridiculous deal.
And now they're thinking of turning it into a website to buy insurance for your pet.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not making – it's not a joke. I mean, it's bizarre. It's like they're trying to figure out what to do with this white elephant that they created, thinking that everybody would want to go, hey, we can sign up for this stuff, And it's just
just shows you how ridiculous this governor and this legislature is here.
Yeah,
and I thought I'd just pass that on to you.
Well, thank you. It's a good stat. I appreciate the call, Jim, and thanks so much for watching Free Speech TV as well there on satellite TV. It's a remarkable commentary on the state of things where the Florida governor Rick Scott, who ran the company that committed the largest Medicaid fraud in the history of the United States. He was CEO of that company. Now he's the governor of Florida. Refuses to expand Medicaid and instead sets up this website where you can sign up for something that looks like Medicaid but isn't. It's run by some private corporation. And 30 people signed up for it. Yeah. Bizarre. 20 minutes past. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind?
I disagree with you, Tom. I think
about
anyone who has difficulty getting employment should be able, within the law, to negotiate a sub-minimum wage just to get employment.
Wow.
Never mind $15 an hour. If he's hard to employ because he lives in a ghetto or because he lives in a barrio or because he's a senior citizen or because he's a woman or a homosexual or whatever, he should be able to negotiate with his prospective employer.
So poor people and gays should be exempted from minimum wage laws? Do I hear that?
No,
sir?
but I understand some gays have difficulty getting a job if they admit they're gay.
Right. So
and if they could negotiate, if anyone who has difficulty getting a job can negotiate.
Tom, do you understand the purpose of minimum wage laws, the rationale behind them?
Tell me.
Okay, we have minimum wage laws predicated on the assumption that there is dignity in work, that whether somebody is cleaning toilets or whether they're a rocket scientist, that if they work a 40-hour week and keep their nose clean, that they should have the ability to have a certain minimum lifestyle in this the richest nation in the world. And that minimum lifestyle,
anybody to that,
which was articulated first by Teddy Roosevelt in 1908, where he talked about the square deal. In fact, we've got the audio of it. I don't know if you can pull that up, Shana. Teddy Roosevelt said that the pieces of a living wage include, he said it would vary by region, but it includes enough to live with morality. You don't have to steal for your food. Enough to take a vacation every year. Enough. Oh, here it is. Can you pause it along the way?
Stand for a living wage.
This is Teddy Roosevelt.
Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation. The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, but must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
Normal standard of living? Okay. Continue.
Oop. Standard high enough to make morality possible.
Enough to make morality possible. You don't have to steal for your food. You can live a decent life. Next.
Provide for education and recreation.
Provide for education and recreation. So you can go to school, you can go to college, you can send your kids to school, you can take a vacation. Next.
Care for immature members of the family.
To provide for immature members of the family. In other words, enough money to raise your children. Next.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness. In other words, to make it through if you're sick. This is basically, you know, the paid sick leave. Go ahead.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. That was the President of the United States in like 1906. It was recorded by Thomas Edison. That was more than 100 years ago, Tom, that concept. And that has been the bedrock concept up until the last 20 years in the United States of the minimum wage, is that if somebody is working hard, they should have this baseline of life in America. And you're coming along saying, but wait a minute, if you're gay or if you're black and you're living in the inner city, or if you're poor and you're living in the inner city or rurally, you shouldn't have that minimum baseline of life.
You should have it if you can get it. You should have it if you get it. But if you can't get it,
then screw you, right?
If you're hard up for a job,
then screw you.
And negotiate any wage that you can get just to get the job experience.
So you should be able
to an employer something if you're willing.
Oh, you can do that right now, Tom. There are lots and lots of employers who have programs called internships that pay, in many cases, nothing at all, where you can get experience. That's a huge ripoff, actually, all across the United States. But, you know, what I'm hearing you say is, oh, gee, you were not a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. You weren't born to a white, wealthy family. You're born poor. You're born a person of color. Or you were born gay. Screw you.
Job. You're having difficulty getting a job. It has nothing to do with luck. It has to do with difficulty in getting a job.
Why do you think anybody in this country, Tom, has difficulty getting a job?
And they should be able to negotiate.
Why do you think anybody in this country might have a difficult time getting a job? Because there have been times in this country when it wasn't difficult to get a job. In the 1940s, 1950s, late 40s, early 50s, throughout the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, throughout the boom part of the deregulation boom in the late 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, there, you know, people were not having a problem getting a job, but you know, this was a result. The reason why people are having a hard time getting jobs now is because of our insane trade policies. We have shipped not just millions of jobs overseas, we've shipped over 50,000 factories overseas. I mean, literally brick by brick by brick, just since George Bush started his presidency 14 years ago. Shouldn't we be attacking the policies that make people rich?
The hard-to-place employee wants a job at any salary.
No, that's not true.
$3 an hour.
That's not true.
Get a job.
That is not true. John McCain tried to make that point in Arizona about 4 years ago when he came out and said, I was doing this show, and we're on the air in Phoenix, and he came out in Tucson, and he came out in all over Arizona, actually, by satellite radio, and he came out and he said, people, the reason why there's all these undocumented immigrants who are picking cabbage and lettuce out in the fields in Arizona, the reason why they're doing that, and quote, you know, and well, I don't know, I can't quote him, but, and, you know, kind of middle-class white people aren't taking those jobs is because the middle-class white people are unwilling to pick lettuce out in the hot sun. He said you could offer them $50 an hour and they wouldn't do it. And his office was flooded with calls from people who were saying, you offer me $50 an hour, I'll come pick lettuce. It's, there are some jobs that people won't do for that price. And that should be the basis of it. Tom, thank you for the call, I think. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yeah, we're going to provide an exemption to the minimum wage law for gay people, for people who live in ghettos.
Really?
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, well, this is interesting. Richard, in Brooksville, Florida, you wanted to talk about maritime flags in courthouses?
Yes, sir. How are you, Tom?
I am well. Are you buying into this conspiracy theory that if a flag has a decorative fringe on it in a courthouse, that means it's a maritime flag and you're the equivalent of out to sea and there's no constitution ruling?
Well, I was wondering about the difference in it and why we use it. It could be explained. I was under the assumption that it was used because statutes were easier to implement than a law.
No, there's no it that's being used. I live in a boat and in a marina, which is filled with boats. And my boat actually came with a flag. And it's just a normal U.S. flag. There's no such thing as a maritime flag, unless you're talking about the flags for, go left, go right, the pennants. But just because somebody has made a flag decorative for a courthouse or something like that does not make it a maritime flag. There's this whole bizarre conspiracy theory around this that, if this courthouse has this kind of flag, then it doesn't operate under the Constitution and you don't have to pay your taxes and all this other stuff. It's nonsense, Richard.
Well, no, I'm not part of a conspiracy theory. I was just wondering why we use a
We don't use maritime flags in our courthouses. There is no such thing as a maritime flag. There is a flag of the United States of America. You find it on boats. You find it in courthouses. You find it flying on the Capitol. There's one flag. That's it. There's
right.
No version for boats.
I remember in school learning about the three stages of government, and one of them was, that's one of the three stages.
There are three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and actually in order, the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. Those are the three branches of government. But none of them have anything to do with maritime law.
Very good. I just didn't. I hear a lot of different things on it, and I knew you were the one to call.
Yeah, I know. There's like all this weird stuff. It's like these people are promising you. If your name is in all caps on your birth certificate, it means that the government's holding a $3 million account in your name, and you're actually a corporation, and you can get that money, and you don't have to pay attention to the laws of the land, and you can become a sovereign citizen, and all. It's a scam. It's just a scam. Right. So, Richard, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And Edward in North Billerica, Massachusetts. Hey, Edward, it says here you want to challenge me on white privilege? Really?
Yes. You may consider this call rather strange coming from someone who's usually a Green Party voter. I voted for Jill Stein in the last presidential election. But I have come to believe, I used to believe, this idea of racial equality. I used to believe the races were equal, and I have since come to believe, after living on this planet for 56 years, I have not seen any real indication that that is true. And I really believe that the whole idea of racial equality is a crock of you know what. And
you realize that the genes that affect the color of a person's skin have no connection. They're not even part of the genome that affects a person's intelligence.
Well, you know,
that
may be true, but all I know is what I see.
And that's exactly the point. You can see the color of another person's skin, and therefore you can choose to treat them poorly. And that's what our society has been doing for 400 years.
Well, what I see is that most whites are smarter than most blacks. Most whites work harder than most blacks.
Edward,
are less violent than most blacks.
You, honest to God, don't know what you're talking about, Edward.
White privilege, because people, they know that this racial equality stuff is a talk of, you know what? There is no racial equality, and okay. I do.
Edward, before I drop your call, let me just say you are a bigot. And that kind of bigotry there's no place for that kind of bigotry in the discourse in this country. You are misinformed, uninformed, and a bigot. Thanks a lot for the call. Rudy in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Rudy, you wanted to talk about white privilege.
Oh, geez. Oh, oof.
Yeah.
This is why, when I listen to I make a point to listen to you every day.
Thank you.
You educate me on so many different levels. And I have to say to my white sisters and brothers that some things that we are ignorant of and we had nothing to do with it. A white person is ignorant of being in a black person's skin. And it's not their fault that they don't understand. But you're trying so hard to make some white folks understand
what white privilege is. By the way, some men to understand what male privilege is, because women will tell you that there's also male privilege.
Yes, and it's gut wrenching. It tears me down because. What it is, if white America don't open their eyes to see exactly what is going on in America, they will be in the same situation that most minorities are in. Because what will happen is evolution has a way of evening the playing field. You know, time, evolution. I would think that kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah.
But Tom, I mean that last caller, he knocked me off my track because I had an idea what I was going to say, and when I'm listening to this guy, tears almost came to my eyes because I'm like, this guy here is. He's not even stupid. He's worse than stupid.
Yeah. This is, I didn't ask him the question. I probably should have, but I'm guessing that this is somebody who's never had any personal contact. I mean, personal as in like friends or neighbors or coworkers with people of color. I'm guessing he's lived in a white bubble his whole life. And his experience of black people is, you know, how they're in the racist ways that they're portrayed in the media.
I tell you this, though. Here in America, if we don't open our eyes to racism, it can potentially destroy this country.
I agree.
So I love your show, man, and I have so much love and respect for you, for what you try to put out every day and to educate people, to you know, for them to understand that privilege is a blessing. Mm. You should take that for granted. You should take that for granted. If anything, you should use that to lift someone up.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to do it. Rudy, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate your heartfelt and very insightful comments. Thanks so much for listening and for sharing with us. Bob in Trabuco Canyon, California. Hey, Bob.
How's it going, Tom?
You want to talk about over-the-counter birth control?
Republican senatorial candidate in Colorado.
Right.
Under the ruse of being a champion for women, he wants to put it over the counter so everybody has access to it, but it gets the insurance companies off the hook. That's
right.
They're paying for it.
Oh, so now women have to pay for their own birth control.
Yeah, and insurance companies don't. I mean, right. If it was a one-payer system where we could negotiate prices, that's one thing. But
yeah, and particularly when you consider the fact that more than half of the women in the United States who are on birth control are not on it to prevent pregnancies. They're on it to do things like regulate their menstrual cycles or, you know, diminish pain from menstrual cycles. I mean, there's medical reasons for it. This is crazy.
And he's not the only Republican saying that, their goal is just to get the insurance companies off the hook.
I see. Okay. I missed that subtlety. I should have figured it out. That, you know, the Republicans, they're all about the money. How, you know, why would they say, oh, let's make birth control pills OTC? Well, of course, it's so that the insurance companies can make more profit so Stephen J. Helmsley can buy another house. And Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Stephen is the CEO of United Healthcare and has taken over $1 billion over the years as the CEO of that company. Jeff in Midvale, Utah. Hey, Jeff, we got just a minute, but you wanted to make a point about disabled people and the subminimum wage?
Disabled people especially are made to work for less than the minimum wage. It's usually part of the some sort of transitional program, really, usually.
Yeah. Well, and if you go back 30 years ago, people would be on Social Security disability and they could work at a subminimum wage job, and it was like spending money and whatnot. But you could actually live on Social Security disability 30 years ago. You can't anymore since Reagan reinvented Social Security in 82.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't. I'm trying to.
Yeah. I don't see how anybody could live on Social Security disability unless they're, you know, living with mom or dad or, you know, they've got, you know, they're in some really, really low cost of living part of the United States. It's just, I mean, this people making $700-$800 a year or a month on this. It's just mind boggling. Jeff, thank you for the call. And thanks for pointing that out. You're so right. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, we got to Bob Nay with the Talk Radio News Service coming up, plus more of your calls, plus we've got a fascinating guest at the top of the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, thanks, Tom. I want to set up my question first. We're in Wisconsin here. We're having a really tight race for governor between Republican Scott Walker and Democrat Mary Burke.
Uh-huh.
And up until recently, one of the main issues has been economic growth and job creation. And up until recently, I've heard that Wisconsin is pretty much down or dead last in the Midwest. And all of a sudden, we get this Walker comes out with this ad saying that we're number three and we're actually ahead of North Dakota, which really led me to be suspect. And yeah. I guess my question to you is, where can I go for a very unbiased outlet to fact check some of these ads? Because it's going to get real crazy around here the next couple months.
Yeah. PolitiFact.org is done by some newspaper down in Florida, and it's a pretty good site. Although they tend to cut conservatives a little slack way more often than I would. OpenSecrets.org is run by a good government group here in Washington, D.C. Say what? There's Snopes.com. I doubt, though, I've never seen Snopes do an individual ad unless it was one that just really super went viral. But in a campaign, yeah, and SourceWatch.org is a very good one, too. So
yeah, and I'd like to see both sides, too, you know, not just the one. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, SourceWatch and Open Secrets and Snopes, they're totally nonpartisan. I mean, they will be criticizing Democrats as well as Republicans. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Barvo, is that right, in Dallas, Texas?
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Tom.
Hey.
Tom, we've talked before, and before I get in my subject, I want to tell you, I admire you for what you do. You and I disagree on I'm a conservative, but you're the kind of person I would like to sit down and have a nice dinner with and share a couple of bottles of wine and talk to. You're very smart. But
well, thank you.
And I really mean that. What I want to talk to you about, I worked in the Middle East starting in 1994, became enthralled with what people I was working around. I'm a Christian, and I began studying and reading on Islam. I have written a book that's being published and working on a second one. Mm. I debate imams quite often. In fact, this week I debated one.
Right.
Sometimes as many as 800-900 people there. I have 7 Qurans. They're not all alike. Some Qurans, when they talk about beheading, some do say beheading, and some say cutting of the neck. But where this comes from, beheading, in 631, Muhammad, after the Battle of the Trench, he beheaded between 6, and they don't know for sure how many.
Barvo, if you're responding to my suggestion to Ben Kinchlow that if a Christian Bible should be in a Navy operated and run hotel room, that a Quran should have equal opportunity. I don't think either one of them should, frankly, on a federal facility. That's my personal opinion.
I was just
saying, hey, if you're going to argue freedom of religion for Christians, you've got to argue freedom of religion for people whose religions you don't like or that you even think is wrong. That was my point.
You do it in this country, of course. That's not true around the world. I didn't call about that. I was calling about, you made a comment about beheading. And
about beheading. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for informing me. I did not realize beheading was in the Quran. Thank you, Barbo. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We will be back 10 minutes before the hour. Bob Ney is up next. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney is with us. Hey, Congressman.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Fine. And I should say author of the brilliant book Sideswiped, which if it's not sitting next to your bed or your coffee table or whatever, you should go to the your favorite place to buy books and get a copy because it's
an amazing book.
Bob, what's going on in the world today?
Well, before we go to the world, I did want to mention 2 domestic issues because everything's kind of overshadowed with Syria. But a federal judge has just restored cuts in early voting in Ohio. That's my home state, so I wanted to mention that. Republicans had reductions in early voting opportunities in the Ohio fall election, and, of course, Ohio's been a pivotal state, so this is a big deal. And a Northern District Court judge here in Northern Ohio has an injunction against the Republican-backed bill, and that because the Secretary of State of Ohio had ended what's called Golden Week when people could register to vote and vote on the same day. So I just wanted to mention that.
Right.
And on another issue, bigger for the country, in a victory for the Obama administration, since the exchange is coming back up in the fall for health care, the Federal Appeals Court in D.C. threw out the earlier ruling that said financial subsidies are not available for people, and there were 2 separate rulings, one contradicted the other. So today, the full D.C. Court of Appeals said it will rehear the case. Now, that erases the lower court ruling that went against the subsidies in the health care bill.
Right.
So this kind of diminishes the prospect that the Supreme Court will take up the issue and the exchange will be going on and they need a few million more people in their projections. So I just thought that would be one less hindrance to the health care bill coming up with the exchange.
Indeed, although this will end up before the Supreme Court, won't it?
Yes, I think eventually will. And then we move on to the world, which is the whole debate over Syria. The president is spending 2 days with the NATO summit, and he's in Wales, and he'll be there also tomorrow. It's probably, Tom, one of the biggest focused summits in the last 65-some years because of a lot of issues with the Ukraine, Afghanistan, and now obviously with ISIS, Syria, and Iraq. Of course, here domestically, there's such a debate raging with a lot of people on the right, and I've been paying pretty close attention with Talk Radio News to these issues. A lot of people on the right are coming up with all types of ideas about students in America, Americans traveling, what they're going to do with passports. So you can kind of see the writing on the wall of a maneuvering of the right wing to come up with some type of ideas that actually aren't dealing so much with over there as much as they're dealing with restrictions of some civil liberties over here on our citizens. I mean, you can just see the writing on the wall on that.
Yep, I think you're right.
And the president doesn't have to take a declaration to the Congress, but of course, I think a lot of people are forgetting the last time the issue of Syria came up and the president had made some statements. The Speaker of the House said that he wanted to be consulted, John Boehner, and then the president consulted and you could hear the crickets chirping, and they didn't want anything to do with it, meaning the Republicans. Well,
in fact, the president came out and he said, we have moved battleships into place. We've got airplanes ready to take off. We've got the bombs loaded. I can push the button in 5 minutes, but I am going to ask Congress to authorize this as the Constitution provides. And he tossed it to John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, and nothing happened.
That was it.
Yeah.
So now, of course, people are saying that the president hasn't done anything, but they really won't clarify, except for a couple of them, maybe Louis Gohmert and the like will say some statements that will tend to be outrageous. But otherwise, it's going to be a coalition. We've talked about this for a couple of months on different radio shows, but it's going to have to be some decisions made through coalitions, and some of those coalitions are with people we don't normally talk to, such as Iran, and also coalitions where Saudi Arabia has a lot to lose with ISIS. Mm-hmm. So when the president is being criticized right now for, you know, not making decisions on his own, this is an issue quite larger than us. And also, Britain seems to really be affected by this even more so than we are.
Yeah, yeah. All of our there and our people going over to Syria to say, I want to join ISIS and that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, big problem.
Britain's had quite a severe problem.
Yep.
And then turning to Ferguson, it'll be very interesting because the Department of Justice has a twofold look at Ferguson and New Jersey. And one would be the fact of
Missouri,
the actual killing of Michael Brown. But the other one is going to be, New Jersey, I'm sorry, Missouri. And the other is the fact of the civil rights history of that town. And the Justice Department, through the past 20 or 25 or so years, will go sometimes when called to or when noticed into a community and take a very detailed look at their history, Tom. And then the Justice Department could come up with a consent agreement, as they call it, where if they find that there are problems, then the city would have to, you know, have a compliance plan. Otherwise, the department would institute one for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be the second track that they're taking. And Speaker Boehner says it's going to be brief but busy. So I don't think you're going to see a lot out of the House. There'll be nothing towards substantive issues.
They're still on vacation this week, right?
Yes, they come back actually for about 12 days, 4 days.
That's a tough work month.
It's a toughie, and they're going to be busy screaming about the president, screaming about Syria, and they'll do. The speaker is not. He's got burned last time, so they're not going to have a government shutdown of any particular type. They don't want to try to.
You're sure he can hold his crazy caucus at bay?
He'll hold them at bay. I still argue they're going to go after him in the fall because he tried to appease all sides, and so I still think they'll go after him on the speakership, but it's the aftermath of after the election. He will be able to hold them. There's enough people that are afraid to do anything of the nature of even towards a shutdown.
Because he has the power to not only bestow gifts upon you, but to punish you seriously.
Oh, yes, and money, and he's done that, and he's ripped people off of committees, and wouldn't hesitate to do it, wouldn't hesitate to stop the flow of money to certain races. He's in a tiny bit of luxury to be able to go after at least a couple of people if he wants of his own party cut the money off.
Amazing. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. Michael Renner is going to join us from World Watch, and then we'll be picking up your calls. So if you're on hold, stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartmann here with you. I'll be getting to your calls shortly. But right now, Michael Renner is on the line with us. He's the senior researcher with the Environment and Society Program of the World Watch Institute, worldwatch.org. And Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Glad to be on your show.
Thanks for joining us. Peak meat? Tell me about this.
Well, you know, when we look at what's happening around the world in terms of meat production, we see a very steady growth in the way of, you know, production of all kinds of meat, so much so that over the past roughly 50 years or so, we've seen a quadrupling of output. And, you know, as you can imagine, that is something that doesn't come easily. It takes a lot of resources, a lot of input in the way of feed, in the way of, you know, water input and so on. And so the question is, you know, how much longer can this expansion continue? You know, is this something that we need to worry about now rather than at some point say, oh my goodness, you know, we've sort of reached a peak point and now we better make the world for last.
So the meat is, what are the numbers on this?
Well, the overall numbers are, and this is according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, that globally in 2013, last year, production of all kinds of meat was estimated at 308.5 million tons. And, you know, that's, as I said earlier, is up about fourfold from the early 60s, which is the earliest time that the FAO, that is this UN agency, actually provides comparable data.
Of course, in the early 60s, there were only, well, when John Kennedy was sworn into office, I think that was the year that we hit our 4th billion people. So there were only 4 billion people on the planet at that time. We hit our 5th billion by 74, I think. 6th billion was 87. So we had, you know, just about half as many people, but 1/4 as much meat.
Right. I mean, I think what's certainly happening is, in part, as you rightly say, we have, of course, a larger population on this planet than was the case 50 years ago. No question about that. And that makes a difference. But what I think also makes quite a big difference is that, of course, the dietary choices that have been very prevalent in the United States and in Europe in particular for a long time are now more and more popular in other countries as people become wealthier, as people see, you know, on television and advertising, the kind of lifestyles that we have taken for granted for a long time. So it's spreading. Although at the same time, you know, when you look at what kind of meat gets eaten mostly in different countries, it varies a whole lot. You know, so not everybody eats as much beef, for example, as Americans do or as Argentinians do.
Right. I spent a fair amount of time over at nutritionfacts.org where the good doctor makes a very compelling case that the 15 leading causes of death in the United States, with a singular exception of accidental death, are all reduced by simply going on a vegan diet. You know, no meat, no dairy products, no eggs. And it's pretty compelling. I mean, should we be making an argument that if you want to save the environment, if you want to save the earth, if you want to reduce, you know, water, which is an increasingly precious resource, water use, you can still eat all you want, just don't eat meat and dairy products.
I think that argument can be made, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of people will say, hold on a second, you know, I enjoy my whatever kind of meat you particularly like, you know, I want to do my barbecue and so on. And I think, you know, an argument can be made that by, you know, reducing meat consumption to, you know, sensible levels, I want to say. Mm-hmm. A lot of the health and environmental gains can still be had. You know, I think what's been happening in generally wealthy countries is that so much gets consumed that we really sort of go from one extreme to the other. You know, I mean, there's a problem for many people on this planet who don't get enough to eat generally, and certainly not enough meat if, you know, if that's what you're going after. But then there are some of us who basically consume too much. So consuming less meat, being a little more judicious about it, also thinking harder about what kind of meat to consume, quite a difference. You had alluded to briefly the, you know, the different impacts of different kinds of meat. If you look at beef in particular, it is very water intensive, and but also because of the way that, you know, that livestock, that cattle is being raised and it's being fattened and so on. Mm-hmm. So if we go instead of beef, you know, with of a choice, say, of eating more pork, for example, or chicken, that alone actually reduces the resource consumption that's inherent in all of this.
Is that because we're feeding grains to our beef cattle and the grains consume enormous amounts of water to grow?
Exactly. That's a very, very large reason. I mean, yeah. So much of the world's grain consumption production, rather, ends up as feed for cattle rather than for human consumption. I mean, it's quite mind-boggling.
Yeah. Hmm. Remarkable stuff. People can learn all about this over at worldwatch.org?
Yes, you can go to the main website that we have. We also have for this, the article I wrote about this topic is part of our Vital Science series, and we have a separate website for that. Which you can find at vitalscience.worldwatch.org.
Okay, great. Vital, V-I-T-A-L?
That's right.
Yeah, vitalscience.worldwatch.org. Great. Michael, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
Great talking with you. Worldwatch.org, Michael Runner, the senior researcher in the Environment and Society Program. ISIS has just released another video. They are trying so hard. They are trying so hard to get the United States to involve itself in a war. They're like, please come fight with us. We want to have a fight with you guys. We want to spill American blood on Iraqi soil. So they got a bunch of people and they rounded them up and they slaughtered them with machine guns, shades of the Nazis during World War II, both with Russian prisoners of war principally and Jews and gays and gypsies. I mean, you know, remarkably horrific stuff. They did this. And the thing that I think is most fascinating, and then I'm going to say this and then I'm going to pick up your calls here. The thing that I think is most fascinating is that the Obama administration is helping to fund researchers who are over in Iraq looking for evidence of war crimes by ISIS. I am of the opinion that Barack Obama, President Obama, is going to try to prosecute these guys as war criminals rather than fight them as warriors. And I think that would be so much more effective. I mean, this is what George W. Bush should have done when 9/11 happened, is he should have, you know, gone off to Afghanistan and arrested bin Laden and his buddies. There was only a couple thousand of them. It wouldn't have been that big a deal. And eventually, you know, we got them all, but or most all of them. But, you know, we did it so stupidly. I mean, we took down two countries. We created two failed states. We killed hundreds of thousands of human beings. We destroyed the lives of millions of people. I mean, it's mind-boggling what we did. And I was listening to BBC last night as I was falling asleep, and they were talking about how we are now looking for evidence of war crimes. And you know, I mean, these guys are just shoveling the evidence out, but we've, you know, now it's like, okay, which one of these guys who has their head covered up? The Nazis didn't cover their faces. These guys are. Which, in my mind, reveals that they know what they're doing is wrong. I mean, they're not proud of it. They're just trying to provoke us. And if we had a president right now that was as stupid, and I use that word advisedly, stupid being, you know, no curiosity, not well informed. When George Bush decided to invade Iraq, he had to have people come into the White House and explain to him the difference between a Sunni and a Shia. Right. If we had a president in the White House right now who was as stupid as George W. Bush, we would be in war in the Middle East right now. I'm just, you know, really grateful we aren't, A, and saying, you know, hey, resist the pressure from the crazies in Congress to go off and do something stupid. Just keep resisting it, Mr. President. We'll be back with your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Shano tells me Congress says that they will debate ISIS, war with ISIS, in 2 weeks. That's interesting. We'll see how that plays. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dan in Troy, Montana. Hey, Dan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Tom. We watch you religiously.
Well, thank you.
And I out-argued a libertarian the other day. I just smoked him.
Because
I watched Tom Hartman.
That's great.
My girlfriend's laughing incoherently about it.
That's great.
But anyway, my question is, since Putin doubled all the social payments in Crimea, why can't President Obama double all the Social Security payments, veterans payments, all federal social payments and pensions by a federal order?
By an executive order.
That?
Yeah, unfortunately, Dan, the Constitution is very explicit about this. Article 1, Section 8. Article 1 deals with the legislative branch of government. Section 8 deals with what Congress can pay for and spend money on. And it makes it very, very clear that the executive branch does not have the power of the purse. They do not. The president does not have the ability, by constitutional law, he does not have the ability to appropriate funds. He can't spend a dime if Congress doesn't authorize it. And let me give you a really, really vivid example of this. He campaigned on closing Guantanamo. And there are more than 80 people in Guantanamo right now who, during the last year of the Bush administration, it was determined these guys all were there by accident or there by malice. I mean, they were virtually all of them were there as a result of our going into Afghanistan and saying we will pay a $5,000 bounty for any terrorist, any al-Qaeda member. And so what was happening was, I mean, you know, the average annual income in Afghanistan is $800 a year. So somebody's offering you $5,000. That's like, you know, the average family income in the United States is $44,000. So, you know, offering somebody eight times that, you know, it'd be like offering somebody in the United States, we'll give you $400,000 if you'll tell us who in your neighborhood is a terrorist. And they'll say, oh, the guy that keeps, you know, his dog keeps pooping on my yard, he's the terrorist. And so what happened was you had a bunch of people who got turned in as terrorists because people either just wanted the money or because they wanted the money and they had some sort of grudge match going with this guy in the neighborhood. And the Bush administration said there's 80 of these guys who are guilty of absolutely nothing. They were taxi drivers. They were civil servants. They were, you know, whatever. And Obama can't release them because Congress put this rider on. This is what Mitch McConnell was talking about when he was speaking to the Koch brothers earlier in the week. He said, I'm going to put riders on everything to tie the president's hands. They put a rider on every appropriation bill since Obama came into office, saying that not $1 of federally appropriated money can be used to close Guantanamo. So he would love to do it. He's issued executive orders to do it, but he can't spend the money. And in fact, the Congressional Research Service, I think it is, has said that when he took five people out of Guantanamo and swapped them for Bo Bergdahl, he actually broke the law. That's the one thing that arguably, if they wanted to impeach him for, they could. So he just doesn't have that kind of power, unfortunately, Dan. It makes sense?
I hear you, Tom.
Yeah.
I love your program.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Dan. And thanks. And keep on debating libertarians.
Oh, yeah. I just smoked him, man. He was going on about the debt, and I put all your talking points.
Great. Good on you, Dan. Keep it up. And thanks a lot for calling. Thanks for watching us on Dish Network there on Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Summer vacation, but hey, I live here in Washington, D.C., where John Boehner. Now, Nancy Pelosi didn't so much do this. When the Democrats control the House of Representatives, and they, you know, the leader actually sets the congressional schedule. And when Nancy Pelosi was running the House, they were in session a fair amount. But now that John Boehner is running the House, hey, belly up to the bar, guys. It's time to have a vacation. So that said, this is still a vacation week in D.C., at least for Congress and all the lobbyists. The city's evacuated. It's empty. It's just amazing. It's going to get so busy when everybody comes back because you got the 535 members of Congress, and then you've got the tens of thousands of people who make their living buying and selling those members of Congress, and they're all going to be back. But because it's still summer, I'll say anything goes summer here for another week, right? Anything you want to talk about. Bernard on in Westfield, Wisconsin. Hey, Bernard, you wanted to respond to a caller from the previous hour?
Yeah, the racist. I just wanted to say 99% of all the school shooters seem to be white. How's the answer to that?
And of serial killers, too.
Mm-hmm.
Serial killers tend to be white. So
he should remember all those young white children, they're minorities now. How should they be treated?
Yeah. It's a very, very, very sad state of affairs when people are still echoing this bell curve nonsense that you know there are racial superiorities and inferiorities. It's really sad. Bernard, thank you for the call. Well said. Jim in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I think our prison system is horrific. It's cruel and unusual. It's completely ineffective. I don't think I've ever heard your ideas on, and I know you have great ideas on what you would do to change it. I can take my answer off the air.
Sure. Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. I would say, number one, we need to do away with private prisons. We've got private prisons in this country that have contracts with state governments that require 90 to 95% occupancy rates. So the state government has no incentive to do away with stupid laws like the war on drugs and things. They just keep shoveling people into these prisons. We also allow the private prisons to lobby for legislation that has nothing to do with prison other than people end up in prison because of it. Private prisons are lobbying for three strikes and you're outlaws. They're lobbying for sentencing guidelines, tougher sentences, you know, taking the decision of how long to send somebody to jail out of the hands of judges, you know, creating it by legislative fiat. And legislators go along with this stuff because they're afraid of being called soft on crime. We need to end that. And so that's step one. And then step two would be to, you know, do like Norway has done and upgrade our prisons. Norway has really good prisons. They actually rehabilitate people. And, you know, they operate on the assumption we're a small country, we're all here together, and somebody goes to jail, they're going to come back out. And they actually do rehabilitation. I encourage you to just, you know, track down online the Norwegian prison system and how it works. It's shocking. And it's not unique to Norway. I mean, Norway is the most advanced of all the Nordic countries in this regard, but you find this in most of the Scandinavian countries and many of the Northern European countries. So, you know, it's just, I say often, our teachers hold our future in their hands, our cops hold our present in their hands. Both need to be paid at a high enough level and be operating in world-class facilities, but be paid at a high enough level that the best and the brightest are attracted to the profession. The same should be true of prison guards. Greg in Livonia, Michigan. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I was just calling to check in with you and let your listeners know that I reinforce your call to encourage them to activism. I ran as a precinct delegate in my community a couple of months ago, and I didn't think I had a snowball's chance to make it. And I, oddly enough, I was elected, and I received even more votes than the mayor.
Wow!
But yeah. I've also been an election observer. I blog. I write into editorials and newspaper. And I call into radio talk shows on occasion. But
that's great. So you are a precinct delegate. You are a precinct committee person.
Yes, sir.
That is spectacular.
And,
people don't realize that's the most important job in politics in America because you're the person who sets the policy, the party platform, and you're the person who decides who are going to be the primary candidates.
Exactly, and it's definitely empowering for people to do that. So I, you know, and if people think that they don't have a chance to make it, and that they're never going to be able to make an impact, they can, because I've forwarded my list of my platform wish list to Lansing, and they cited, I believe they're considering those items, one of which was to ban any drilling within 10 miles of the Great Lakes.
Wow.
You know, things like that. And hopefully we'll see some legislation such as that enacted.
Good stuff. And if enough good people like you, Greg, become precinct committee persons or precinct delegates, then you absolutely will see that. And this is what everybody needs to show up. You know, whether you're a Democrat or a principled Republican, show up at the meetings. Was it when you first went to your first Democratic Party meeting? What did you see?
Well, I saw mostly elderly folks there, frankly.
Yeah.
To be blunt about it, and it's people that have been experienced enough in the process that that know and understand that sitting on the sidelines is not an option.
Right.
And I don't see that many younger people, but there is a great deal of energy in the Democratic Party in Michigan right now, and we are poised, hopefully, to start taking this state back from some of the powers that be that have done what they have to it. I'm also a union member, and they've really torn this state apart, I think,
yeah,
and what they're doing. And I think furthermore, I think that even worse legislation is if Snyder gets in again, I think even worse legislation is coming down the pike.
Right.
Abolishing the 40-hour work week and child labor laws, things that we're seeing in other states with the ALEC pattern legislation.
Yep, I absolutely agree. Greg, Shano says he wants you to be our book winner of the day. Would you like a copy of The Crash of 2016 by me?
Oh, yeah, I'd love that.
Cool. Okay, awesome. Let me put you on hold. Danielle will pick you up. He's on line 5, Danielle. And we'll get a book autographed and off to you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your calls and my thoughts and the news of the day and what's the latest on what's going on with ISIS right after this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you 28 minutes before the hour. The Justice Department is soon going to be announcing that they are launching a civil rights investigation into the activities of the police department in Ferguson, Missouri. This should be interesting. Keep an eye on this space. ISIS has committed an atrocity, a mass murder, and now released the video on it to brag about it. These guys are psycho. They're war criminals. They need to be arrested. They need to be stopped, and it needs to be done by people within the region. They need to, they're neighbors. Anyhow, we talked about that yesterday with Congressman Grayson. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan.
Good morning, or afternoon, I guess, there.
There you go.
What I want to talk about is I think we're already headed towards the next Great Depression. It's already happening. And I kind of just from viewing the stock market and so forth and picking up bits on the news, it was a statement that had came out by DePaul University, and it was Al Jazeera that reported, and of course, faux news, but it was regarding the housing market.
Right.
That Blackstone, American Homes, American Residential Property, and I don't know which rich entrepreneur mogul, if it is Pickett or Buffett, but instead of hotels, it's Berkshire Hathaway Apartments. And then I started watching the different Bloomberg and, of course, unfortunately, that faux news that does give the report of the market. And then there's also something called Apartment Hunter, which only has furnished units, so it, like, ups the cost. Right. The other thing that I see why it's teetering back to where it was right before we had the fall in 2008, mm-hmm, is, and again, I know you don't like it when I say it, but FedEx is the one that delivers people their foreclosure or somehow to maybe get a modification paper. Mm-hmm. And it got up to $157 a share, and it currently is trading and fluxing just right at 152. And I've been tracking this since February when it was down at like 138, and it has just been, ahead of the other transportations.
Yeah, although, FedEx is... The reason, I think that the reason that both FedEx and UPS are doing really, really well right now, and the U.S. Postal Service as well, with regard to packages, is Amazon. Amazon has become the nation's largest retailer. Amazon is threatening the business model of Walmart. Amazon is putting small businesses out of business all across the country. at least those small businesses that haven't figured out a way to get into Amazon's business model. And Amazon now has developed their own package delivery contractors to cut FedEx and UPS out of the loop. And that's just starting. It's just growing. But some very, very interesting changes in the market. But I agree with you. I believe that a crash and Great Depression are absolutely inevitable, and I think that they're going to happen in the next 2 years. That's why I wrote the book, The Crash of 2016.
Well, when you read the feature of DePaul University, and I don't recall the fellow who had done the study, he was the one who was explaining it. And it was strange because Ali Vesey was sitting there saying, well, you know, that's great that these things are doing wonderful. It's like, did this just miss your head of why they're doing wonderful?
Right.
Back to your friend that you had on in the second hour, Ben Knows of the 700 Club. Has he ever looked at these Bibles that they supply? I mean, flip it over, it's glittery, and it probably says China somewhere's on there. Does he agree with everything that China has to offer, too?
Yeah, there you go. Printed in China. Good rhetorical point, Susan. Thank you very much. Thanks for sharing your observations with us. Betty in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Betty.
Good afternoon, Tom. Tom, I think that our president could make a lasting impression around the world, one of historical significance, if he stood behind the prosecution of our own war criminals, a.k.a. Bush and company.
Yeah, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld,
I really believe
Rice.
In that. Yeah. Absolutely. Rice, Bremer, the entire entourage.
Right.
Also, in response to your the caller, the racist caller that called about 45 minutes ago, I had to check myself about where I was because it took me back to my days when I studied in South Africa. I studied there during the height of apartheid for a year from 1970 to 71, and clearly remember sitting around the dinner table with my British transplant family who would ridicule the black South Africans and say, after all, we are their superiors, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I want to recommend a book for all that are concerned about this topic, and that's a book called Kaffir Boy, K-A-F-F-I-R, by Mark Mathabane, who was a tennis protege discovered by Ned Chase, Chevy Chase's father, I want to say back in the 60s, 70s. He came over here encouraged by Ned Chase because he was brilliant at tennis, and Kaffir Boy is all about his experiences here and the problems that he met, and a fascinating through the eyes of a black South African coming to America.
Hmm. That sounds fascinating. I'll have to check it out. K-A-F-F-I, is that like the fermented milk drink?
Kaffir, K-A-F-F-I-R.
Okay.
It's kind of not a very nice name for, that's how they refer to the black South Africans.
Oh, that's the South African version of the N-word here?
That's correct.
I see. Okay. Betty, thank you for that. I appreciate the information. I'll have to check it out. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky.
Yeah, let's try this again.
Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to say that Lindsey Graham and McCain are suffering from the Burmese syndrome. They bring home this group, Isa, and they treat it like their pet snake, and they nurture it, and they feed it, and they take it to the vet when it's sick, and when it grows up and don't need them no more, it turns on them.
Right.
Now, I'd like you and Mike Papp, when you guys talk, because you always reference history and bring it to the future.
Right.
I'd like to do the same thing. They did the same thing in the 80s with Reagan when they backed the Contras. You know, they went down there and they destroyed South America.
Well, not Central America, and it was Honduras, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. Yeah, you're right. And that's why, you know, I mean, those death squads, John Negroponte going down to El Salvador, and suddenly, you know, a few weeks later or a few months later, there are people, you know, with their hands tied behind their back and a bullet in their head. And then he went over to Iraq, and all of a sudden people with a bullet in the back of their head and their hands tied behind their back started showing up in Iraq. I mean, it's
well,
like...
Bishop Romero.
Yeah.
He wrote to Ronald Reagan. He wrote him a letter saying, please, do not send any more arms down here to these Contras. they're killing the indigenous people.
Yeah.
They were walking into their house and murdering.
Yeah, I'm with you. Corky, I got to interrupt you because Eric Holder
Director
is speaking.
Ron Davis of the
Hang on just a second. Here we go.
Services or the cops office. We are here today to announce the latest steps in the Justice Department's ongoing efforts to address the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, and the surrounding communities. Now, as you know, our federal civil rights investigation into the August 9th shooting death of Michael Brown remains open and remains very active. As I made clear during my visit to Ferguson 2 weeks ago, this investigation will take time. But the American people can have confidence that it will be fair, it will be thorough, and it will be independent. Over the course of that visit, I had the chance to speak with a number of local residents. I heard from them directly about the deep mistrust that has taken hold between law enforcement officials and members of that community. In meetings, as well as in listening sessions, as well as informal conversations, people consistently express concerns stemming from specific alleged incidents, from general policing practices, and from the lack of diversity on the Ferguson police force. These anecdotal accounts underscore the history of mistrust of law enforcement in Ferguson that has received a good deal of attention. As a result of this history, and following an extensive review of documented allegations and other available data, we have determined that there's cause for the Justice Department to open an investigation to determine whether Ferguson police officials have engaged in a pattern or practice of violations of the United States Constitution or federal law. This investigation will be carried out by a team from the Civil Rights Division's Special Litigation Section, some of the same dedicated professionals who have achieved really historic results in ensuring constitutional policing from coast to coast. Over the past 5 years, the Civil Rights Division has prosecuted over 300 individual officers for misconduct. We have opened 20 pattern or practice investigations into police departments across the country. That's more than twice as many as were opened in the previous 5 years. And we're enforcing 14 agreements to reform law enforcement practices at agencies both large and small. With these agreements, we have seen dramatic decreases in excessive uses of force, greater equity in the delivery of police services, including important measures to address bias, and most significantly, increased confidence by communities in their law enforcement agencies. Now, as the brother of a retired police officer, I know that the overwhelming majority of our brave men and women in uniform do their jobs honorably. They do them with integrity and often at great personal risk. The Civil Rights Division's efforts are simply meant to ensure that law enforcement officers in every part of the United States live up to those same high standards of professionalism. In Ferguson, our investigation will assess the police department's use of force, including deadly force. It will analyze stops, searches, and arrests.
This is Attorney General Holder at the Justice Department announcing a civil rights investigation into the police department of the city of Ferguson, Missouri. Fascinating stuff. We'll be back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out our newly reinvented website at TomHartman.com. You can make a blog, you can participate in our message boards, there's all kinds of things. And welcome back. Victor in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You had some information on misleading Scott Walker ads in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we were surprised when that ad came out where he was saying we were number one in this and number one in that and beat all the other states around us. And it was confusing because we've seen all to the contrary data coming out. My wife pointed out there's a moment, very brief moment, where something flashes on the screen in small print that gives a specific time frame for what that data covers. Rather than his whole term, which he had talked about and all other people seem to be talking about. There was one period, I'm not even sure what it was, where apparently he might have been correct, but that doesn't cover everything.
So he's saying, like, we had a 7% increase in employment between June 30th, 2011 and August 16th, 2011 or something like that. He's cherry-picking some little time period.
Right. And I think PolitiFact, I have been very disappointed in them because although they may seem to give a statement that was made that may have facts in it that they would check, they would then tend to, in my opinion, lean to giving better scores to conservatives like Ron Johnson and other people than to liberals like Feingold and so on. For example, they might say, for example, yes, Walker did give $750 million to those people that supported him in the recall and so on. However, they also gave money to the Democrats. Therefore, they may relate, they may give that statement as mostly false or, you know, something like that and saying mostly true.
Right.
That's where the problem I have with them. And also Rachel Maddow did a couple programs on that several months ago about how disappointed she was in them and the things that they used and reported.
Yeah. Okay. Great point.
So I just would say you may want to get a hold of her show or find out, but maybe not trust some of these.
No, I've come up across this against this PolitiFact on a number of occasions, where it seems to me like they're trying to do 50-50. They're trying to knock the Republicans and the Democrats an equal amount of time. And the fact of the matter is that Republicans are much more likely to lie in their ads because their messages are not consonant with the desires of the American people. You know, they're just promoting the agenda of the billionaires and the banksters. So
that's what I think. I think it's a matter of fact that I believe the Republicans tend to lie more than the Democrats. Maybe not.
No, I'll say it as a statement of fact, and there's a reason for it. Democrats, and Harry Truman said this so well. I used to have this clip on my 360 here. Harry Truman said, you know, the Democrats are for the working people and the Republicans are for the rich and the big corporations. And they always have been and they always will be. And it's just a simple statement of fact. That was 1943 that he said that. And it's 46 or 47. And it's still the case. And so if you're working on behalf of the billionaires, if you're an Eric Cantor, and you know that there's a $3.5 million job waiting for you if you just do what the banksters want, you've got to figure out a way to get people to vote for you, with your campaign ads. It means you've got to lie in your campaign ads. Victor, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the information. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We just got a call from a fellow in Wisconsin who said that the reason the Walker ads say that, you know, hey, we're number three in job creation and all this kind of stuff, he says if you watch really carefully, they flash on the screen the date that he's talking about. And it's not his entire administration. He's slicing and dicing little moments in time and finding those times when these numbers looked really good and ignoring the times when the numbers look really bad, which proves, I think it was Abraham Lincoln's old statement, that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. So thank you for that. Joan in Spencer, New York, listen to WNYY. Hey, Joan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to thank you so much for educating me for the last 7 years.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You hear me all right?
Yeah, I hear you just fine. You had a question?
Yes, well, it was... add a little levity to the program. Last spring, you talked about pigeons and the xenon, and you've never seen a baby pigeon, or you've never seen a dead pigeon.
Right.
But Louise found the pigeons in the electric box at your boat.
Yeah, on our boat.
They actually turned into pigeons.
Yep. They're in fact, interestingly, we just ordered some of these little pigeon guard things. They're bird guard things. They're these little pointy stakes that stick up, and you put them down with glue on the edge of windowsills and things so birds don't land on them. The babies have reached the size, and now I know why you don't ever see baby pigeons, but don't tell anybody this, because we have to maintain this story that they're actually robots of the planet Xenu. But this is just fascinating to me. The baby pigeons stay with their parents until they're so big that they look like adult pigeons, and they're about that big right now, although they're kind of a reddish color. I'm guessing that they'll get
How old are they?
They're 3 months old now, 2 months old, two, three, 4 months.
Ah.
I don't know, but they're big, and they kicked the nest out a long time ago. I mean, they just sit in there. The space is about 3 feet long and about, you know, 8 or 10 inches high and 8 or 10 inches wide, where the rope comes in to tie the boat up around the cleat. And they're still in there, and as soon as they leave, which should be hopefully any day now, we're going to put these no pigeon strips in there so that they don't come back. So that's the story, Joan.
Oh, that is fascinating. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Whatever happens.
Thanks.
All righty. Bye-bye.
And of course, they're not really pigeons. They're actually cleverly painted doves. Steve in Chicago, you wanted to talk about Ukraine?
Yes, if I might. Sure. I actually heard you discussing it yesterday, and I tried to call in. It does seem to me that you make a very good point with regard to the way in which this conflict evolved. The notion of NATO expansion, something that you don't hear talked about. However,
in the U.S.
predicated, but yes, exactly, U.S. and Western Europe and so forth are NATO allies. Now, it is to some degree predicated on the notion that NATO expansion is a tangible threat, a real threat to the Russian Federation. And I can't foresee any strange alternative, bizarro universe in which the United States attacks the Russian Federation or poses some threat. And this is, quite frankly, what Vladimir Putin is playing upon. Now, whether he actually believes it or he's simply exploiting it for political reasons, because, you know, he's certainly under attack in his own country.
What do you think would happen here, Steve, if Putin made a deal with Castro to put nuclear weapons, and we are talking about battlefield tactical nuclear weapons here with NATO, to put nuclear weapons in Cuba again, or to try to do it again, like he did in 62?
Oh, well, I certainly think that the U.S. would protest. Whether or not we would engage in a military action is doubtful. But
we damn near took Cuba in 62.
But that's exactly the point. This is not 1985. It's not 1975. It's not 1965. We are long past the Cold War, and NATO is as much an economic and political entity as it is a military one.
I agree, but there's an actual hot war going on in Ukraine right now. There have been several thousand people killed.
Right. And absolutely, I would argue, is partly predicated on, and the reality is one needs to understand the history of Russian people who have considered themselves embattled for centuries and surrounded by enemies. And
well, look at what happened with World War II. I mean, Russia lost more people than any other country in the world.
Absolutely. And that is a rational, real threat. Now, the question again becomes, to what extent is this legitimate? Let's assume that Ukraine
Russia lost people to the Nazis in World War II, and there are Nazis, open Nazis, in the parliament and in the cabinet of the current regime in Ukraine. Wouldn't that make you a little skitsy if you were the next-door neighbor?
No, it would not, because there are extremists in every nation of that sort. The question is there any threat that those extremists, such that being in power, first of all, they're not in power, they represent a small contingent of Ukraine, and certainly they're not in a position to create any sort of military action against the Russian Federation at now or at any point in the future, which is the entire underlying rationale for what Putin is doing. In other words, is NATO a threat? Is NATO ever going to engage in any sort of military action against the Russian Federation, given that Russia is a formidable military power with nuclear weapons?
Right.
The answer to that is absolutely not. So, yeah, I agree with you.
This is what people were saying in 1914, Steve. There's no way that we're going to have a world war. We've got all these treaties.
There's a reason why during the Cold War we didn't go to war. This is an entirely different world than it was in 1914.
But Article 5 of NATO says that if any NATO country is attacked, that's an attack on all NATO countries, and they all must respond. This is what the president was speaking to in Tallinn a couple of days ago in Estonia, yesterday.
Right, exactly. And during the height of the Cold War, NATO versus the Warsaw Pact, guess what? We never went to war.
No, but you weren't seeing changing boundaries. You know, the industrial cities of eastern Ukraine principally were making manufacturing heavy goods for the Russian army. You know, I'm not trying to be an apologist for Putin here. My point is that I think that the idea of a demilitarized state on your border is not a bad idea for us or for them. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. We'll have to get into this in more depth tomorrow, I guess. So Anyhow, coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That's Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about all the important issues of the week and taking your calls, too, plus anything goes Friday. A chance to pick the topics we talk about, what's on your mind. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag your in. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.